Regardless of how well Marion had rehearsed this Friday, she had been mistaken to think that Ted's only recourse for a ride home would be to walk all the way to his squash opponent's office and wait for Dr. Leonardis, or for one of the doctor's patients, to drive him to Sagaponack. Dave Leonardis's office was on the far side of Southampton, on the Montauk Highway. The bookstore was not only closer to Mrs. Vaughan's mansion, it was a much more obvious place for Ted to expect to be rescued. Ted Cole could have walked into almost any bookstore in the world and asked for a ride home. He promptly did so, no sooner than he'd sat down at the autographing table to sign his books. "To put it simply, I need a ride home," the famous author said. "A ride!" cried Mendelssohn. "Yes, of course, no problem. You live in Sagaponack, don't you? I'll take you myself. Well, I'll have to call my wife. She may be shopping, but not for long. You see, my car's in the shop." "I hope it's not in the same shop my car was in," Ted told the enthusiast. "I just got mine back from the shop. They forgot to reattach the steering column. It was like that cartoon we've all seen. The steering wheel was in my hands, but it was not attached to the wheels. I steered one way, the car went off the road in another. Fortunately, all I hit was privet, a vast hedge. Climbing out the driver's side window of the car, I was scratched by the bushes. And then I stepped in a goldfish pool," Ted explained. He had their attention now. Mendelssohn, poised by the phone, delayed the call to his wife. And the formerly dumbstruck young woman who worked there was smiling. Ted was not generally attracted to what he thought of as her type, but if she offered him a ride home, maybe something would come of it. She was probably not long out of college. In her no-makeup, straight-hair, no-tan way, she was a precursor of the decade ahead. She was not pretty. Truly, she was just plain dull. But her paleness represented a kind of sexual frankness to Ted, who recognized that a part of the young woman's no-frills appearance reflected an openness to experiences she might call creative. She was the kind of young woman who was seduced intellectually. Ted's particularly scruffy appearance at the moment might actually have elevated him in her eyes. And sexual encounters, because the woman was still young enough to find them novel, were doubtless an area of experience she might call authentic, especially with a famous writer. Sadly, she didn't have a car. "I use a bicycle," she told Ted, "or else I take you home." Too bad, Ted thought. But he rationalized that he didn't really like the discrepancy between the thinness of her lower lip and the exaggerated puffiness of her upper. Mendelssohn fretted because his wife was still out shopping. He would keep calling. She would be back soon, Mendelssohn assured Ted. A boy with an indescribable speech impediment, the only other staff in the bookstore on this Friday morning, offered an apology for he had lent his car to a friend who'd want her to go to the beach. Ted just sat there, slowly signing books. It was only 10. If Marion had known where Ted was and how close he could be to getting a ride home, she might have panicked. If Eddie O'Hare had known that Ted was autographing books across the street from the frame shop, where Eddie was insisting that the feet photograph should be ready for Ruth to take home today, Eddie might have panicked too. But there was no cause for Ted to feel any panic. He didn't know that his wife was leaving him. He still imagined that he was leaving her. And he was safely off the streets. Therefore, he was out of immediate harm's way, meaning Mrs. Vaughan. And even if Mendelssohn's wife never came home from shopping, it was only a matter of minutes before someone would come into the bookstore who was a devoted Ted Cole reader. It would probably be a woman, and Ted would actually have to buy one of his own autographed books for her, but she would give him a ride home. And if she was good-looking, and so on and so forth, who knew what might come of it? Why panic at 10 o'clock in the morning, Ted was thinking. He had no idea. How the writer's assistant became a writer. Meanwhile, in the nearby frame shop,
Eddie O'Hare was finding his voice. At first, Eddie was unaware of the powerful change within him. He thought he was merely angry. There was reason to be angry. The saleswoman who waited on Eddie was rude to him. She was not much older than he, but she too brusquely estimated that a 16-year-old boy and a 4-year-old girl asking about the matting and framing of a single 8x10 photograph were not high on the list of those well-heeled Southampton patrons of the arts whom the frame shop sought to serve. Eddie asked to speak to the manager, but the saleswoman was rude again. She repeated that the photograph was not ready. "Next time," she told Eddie, "I suggest that you call before you come." "Do you want to see my stitches?" Ruth asked the saleswoman. "I got a scab, too." The saleswoman, a girl, really, clearly had no children of her own. She pointedly ignored Ruth, which raised Eddie's anger to a higher level. "Show her your scar, Ruth," Eddie said to the 4-year-old. "Look," the salesgirl began. "No, you look," Eddie said, still not understanding that he was finding his voice. He'd never spoken to anyone in this manner before. Now, suddenly, he was unable to stop. His newfound voice continued. "I'm willing to keep trying with someone who's rude to me, but I won't have anything to do with someone who's rude to a child," Eddie heard himself say. "If there's no manager here, there must be someone else. Whoever it is who does the actual work, for example. I mean, is there a back room where the mats are cut and the pictures are framed? There must be someone here besides you. I'm not leaving without that photograph, and I'm not talking to you." Ruth looked at Eddie. "Did you got mad at her?" the 4-year-old asked him. "Yes, I did," Eddie replied. He felt unsure of who he was, but the salesgirl would never have guessed that Eddie O'Hare was a young man who was often full of doubt. To her, he was confidence itself. He was absolutely terrifying. Without a word, she retreated to the very same back room that Eddie had so confidently mentioned. Indeed, there were two back rooms in the frame shop, a manager's office and what Ted would have called a workroom. Both the manager, a Southampton socialite and divorcee named Penny Pierce, and the boy who cut the mats and framed, and framed and framed, all day, were there. The unpleasant salesgirl conveyed the impression that Eddie, despite his appearance to the contrary, was scary. While Penny Pierce knew who Ted Cole was, and she vividly remembered Marion because Marion was beautiful, Mrs. Pierce did not know who Eddie O'Hare was. The child, she presumed, was the unlucky little girl Ted and Marion had had to compensate for their dead sons. Mrs. Pierce vividly remembered the sons, too. Who could forget the frame shop's good fortune? There had been hundreds of photographs to mat and frame, and Marion had not chosen inexpensively. It had been an account in the thousands of dollars, Penny Pierce recalled. The shop really should have rematted and reframed the single photograph with the blood-stained mat promptly. "We should probably have done it gratis," Mrs. Pierce now considered. But just who did this teenager think he was? Who was he to say he wasn't leaving without the photograph? "He's scary," the fool salesgirl repeated. Penny Pierce's divorce lawyer had taught her one thing. Don't let anyone who's angry talk. Make them put it in writing. She'd carried this policy with her into the framing business, which her ex-husband had bought for her as a part of the divorce settlement. Before Mrs. Pierce confronted Eddie, she instructed the boy in the workroom to stop what he was doing and immediately remat and reframe the photograph of Marion in the Hotel de Quai Voltaire. It was the first time that Penny Pierce had seen this particular photo in, what was it now, about 5 years? Mrs. Pierce remembered Marion bringing in all the snapshots. Some of the negatives were scratched. When the boys had been alive, the old pictures of them had been taken for granted and not very well cared for. After the boys had died, Penny Pierce assumed, almost every snapshot of them had struck Marion as worthy of enlarging and framing, scratched or not. Knowing the story of the accident, Mrs. Pierce had not been able to restrain herself from looking closely at all the photographs. "Oh, it's this one," she said when she saw the picture of Marion in bed with her boy's feet. What had always struck Penny Pierce about this photograph was the evidence of Marion's distinct happiness, in addition to her unmatched beauty. And now Marion's beauty was unchanged, while at the same time her happiness had fled. This fact about Marion was universally striking to other women. While neither beauty nor happiness had entirely abandoned Penny Pierce, she felt that she'd never known either to the extent that Marion had. Mrs. Pierce gathered a dozen or more sheets of stationery from her desk before she approached Eddie. "I understand that you're angry. I'm very sorry about that," she said pleasantly to the handsome 16-year-old, who looked to her incapable of frightening anyone. "I have got to get better help," Penny Pierce was thinking to herself as she went on, visually underestimating Eddie. The closer she looked at him, the more she thought he was too pretty to qualify as handsome. "When my customers are angry, I ask them to voice their complaints in writing, if you don't mind," Mrs. Pierce added, again pleasantly. The 16-year-old saw that the manager had presented him with paper and a pen. "I work for Mr. Cole. I'm a writer's assistant," Eddie said. "Then you won't mind writing, will you?" Penny Pierce replied. Eddie picked up the pen. The manager, she was neither beautiful nor brimming with happiness, but she was nevertheless not unattractive, and she was good-natured, smiled at him encouragingly. No, he wouldn't mind writing, Eddie realized. It was exactly the invitation that Eddie needed. It was what his voice, long trapped inside him, wanted. He wanted to write. After all, that was why he had wanted the job. What he'd got, instead of writing, was Marion. Now that he was losing her, he was finding what he'd wanted before the summer started. And it wasn't Ted who'd taught him anything. What Eddie O'Hare had learned from Ted Cole, he'd learned from reading him. It was from just a few sentences that any writer learned anything from another writer. From the mouse crawling between the walls, Eddie had learned something from only two sentences. The first one was this: Tom woke up, but Tim did not. And then there was this sentence. It was a sound like, in the closet, if one of Mommy's dresses came alive and it tried to climb down off the hanger. If, because of that sentence, Ruth Cole would think differently of closets and dresses for the rest of her life, Eddie O'Hare could hear the sound of that dress coming alive and climbing down off that hanger as clearly as any sound he'd ever heard. He could see the movement of that slithery dress in the half-dark of that closet in his sleep. And from the door in the floor, there was another first sentence that wasn't half bad. There was a little boy who didn't know if he wanted to be born. After the summer of 58, Eddie O'Hare would finally understand how that little boy felt. There was this sentence, too. His mommy didn't know if she wanted him to be born either. It was only after he'd met Marion that Eddie understood how that mommy felt. That Friday in the frame shop in Southampton, Eddie O'Hare had a life-changing realization. If the writer's assistant had become a writer, it was Marion who'd given him his voice. If when he'd been in her arms, in her bed, inside her, he'd felt for the first time that he was almost a man, it was losing her that had given him something to say. It was the thought of his life without Marion that provided Eddie O'Hare with the authority to write. "Do you have a picture of Marion Cole in your mind?" Eddie wrote. "I mean, in your mind's eye, can you see exactly what she looks like?" Eddie showed his first two sentences to Penny Pierce. "Yes, of course. She's very beautiful," the manager said. Eddie nodded. Then he kept on writing as follows. "Okay. Although I am Mr. Cole's assistant, I have been sleeping with Mrs. Cole this summer. I would estimate that Marion and I have made love about 60 times. 60? Mrs. Pierce said aloud. She'd come around the countertop so that she could read what he wrote over his shoulder. Eddie wrote, "We've been doing it for 6, almost 7 weeks, and we usually do it twice a day, often more than twice a day. But there was the time she had a bladder infection and we couldn't do it, and when you take into consideration her period..."
"I see, about 60 times, then," Penny Pierce said. "Go on."
"Okay," Eddie wrote. "While Marion and I have been lovers, Mr. Cole, his name is Ted, has had a mistress. She was his model, actually. Do you know Mrs. Vaughn?"
"The Vaughns on Gin Lane? They have quite a collection," the frame shop manager said.
Now there was a framing job she would have liked.
"Yes, that Mrs. Vaughn," Eddie wrote. "She has a son, a little boy."
"Yes, yes, I know," said Mrs. Pierce. "Please go on."
"Okay," Eddie wrote. "This morning, Ted, that is, Mr. Cole, has broken up with Mrs. Vaughn. I don't imagine that there could have been a very happy resolution to their affair. Mrs. Vaughn seemed pretty upset about it. And meanwhile, Marion is packing up. She's leaving. Ted doesn't know she's leaving, but she is. And Ruth, this is Ruth, she's 4.
"Yes, yes," Penny Pierce interjected.
"Ruth doesn't know her mother is leaving either," Eddie wrote. "Both Ruth and her father are going to go back home to the house in Sagaponack and realize that Marion is gone. And all the photographs, those pictures that you framed, every one of them, except the one you have here in the shop..."
"Yes, yes, my God, what?" Penny Pierce said.
Ruth scowled at her. Mrs. Pierce tried her best to smile at the child. Eddie wrote, "Marion is taking the pictures with her. When Ruth gets home, both her mother and all the pictures will be gone. Her dead brothers and her mother will be gone. And the thing about those photographs is that there's a story that goes with all of them. There are hundreds of stories, and Ruth knows each and every one of them by heart."
"What do you want from me?" Mrs. Pierce cried.
"Just the photograph of Ruth's mother," Eddie said aloud. "She's in a bed in a hotel room in Paris."
"Yes, I know the picture. Of course you can have it," Penny Pierce said.
"That's it, then," Eddie said. He wrote, "I just thought that the child would probably really need to have something to put near her bed tonight. There won't be any other pictures, all those pictures she's been used to. I thought that if there were one of her mother, especially..."
"But it's not a good picture of the boys, only their feet," Mrs. Pierce interrupted.
"Yes, I know," Eddie said. "Ruth particularly likes the feet."
"Are the feet ready?" the 4-year-old asked.
"Yes, they are, dear," Penny Pierce said solicitously to Ruth.
"Do you want to see my stitches?" the child asked the manager.
"And my scab?"
"The envelope is in the car, Ruth. It's in the glove compartment," Eddie explained.
"Oh," Ruth said. "What's a glove department?"
"I'll go check to be sure that the photograph is ready," Penny Pierce announced. "It's almost ready, I'm sure."
Nervously, she scooped up the pages of stationery from the countertop, although Eddie still held the pen. Before she could leave his side, Eddie caught her by the arm.
"Excuse me," he said, handing her the pen. "The pen is yours, but could I please have my writing back?"
"Yes, of course," the manager replied.
She handed him all the paper, even the blank sheets.
"What did you did?" Ruth asked Eddie.
"I told the lady a story," the 16-year-old explained.
"Tell me the story," the child said.
"I'll tell you another story in the car," Eddie promised her, "after we get the picture of your mommy."
"And the feet,"
the 4-year-old insisted.
"The feet, too," Eddie promised.
"What story are you going to tell me?"
Ruth asked him.
"I don't know," the boy admitted.
He would have to think of one. Surprisingly, he wasn't in the least bit worried about it. One would come, he was sure. Nor was he worried any more about what he had to say to Ted. He would tell Ted everything that Marion had told him to say and anything else that came into his mind. "I can do it," he believed. He had the authority. Penny Pierce knew he had it, too.
When the manager re-emerged from the back rooms of the frame shop, she brought more than the rematted, reframed photograph with her. Although Mrs. Pierce had not changed her clothes, she had somehow transformed herself. She brought with her a substantially revised presence, not merely a fresh scent, a new perfume, but a change in attitude that made her almost alluring. To Eddie, she was borderline seductive. He'd not really noticed her as a woman before. Her hair, which had been up, was down. There'd been some alterations in her makeup, too. Exactly what Mrs. Pierce had done to herself was not hard for Eddie to pinpoint. Her eyes were darker and more pronounced. Her lipstick was darker, too. Her face, if not more youthful, was more flushed. And she'd opened her suit jacket and pushed up the sleeves, and the top two buttons of her blouse were unbuttoned. Only the topmost button had been unbuttoned before. In bending down to show Ruth the photograph, Mrs. Pierce revealed a depth of cleavage that Eddie would never have guessed at. When she stood up, she whispered to Eddie, "There's no charge for the photograph, of course." Eddie nodded and smiled. But Penny Pierce was not through with him. She showed him a page of stationery. She had a question for him, in writing, because it wasn't a question that Mrs. Pierce would ever have asked out loud in front of the child. "Is Marion Cole leaving you, too?" Penny Pierce had written. "Yes," Eddie told her. Mrs. Pierce gave his wrist a comforting little squeeze. "I'm sorry," she whispered. Eddie didn't know what to say. "Did the blood get all gone?" Ruth asked. It was a miracle to the 4-year-old that the photograph had been so completely restored. As a result of the accident, she herself bore a scar. "Yes, dear, it's as good as new," Mrs. Pierce told the child. "Young man," the manager added, as Eddie took Ruth by the hand, "if you're ever interested in a job..." Since Eddie had the photograph in one hand and Ruth's hand in his other hand, he had no hand free to take the business card that Penny Pierce held out to him. In a move that reminded Eddie of Marion putting the $10 bill in his right rear pocket, Mrs. Pierce deftly inserted the card into the left front pocket of the boy's jeans. "Perhaps next summer, or the summer after that. I'm always looking for help in the summer," the manager said. Again, Eddie didn't know what to say. Once more, he nodded and smiled. It was a posh place, the frame shop. The display room was tasteful. There were mostly examples of customized frames. The poster art, always a favorite in the summer, featured movie posters of the 30s, Greta Garbo as Anna Karenina, Margaret Sullivan as the woman who dies and becomes a ghost at the end of Three Comrades. Also, liquor and wine advertisements were popular poster material. There was a dangerous-looking woman sipping a Campari and soda, and a man as handsome as Ted Cole was drinking a martini made with just the right amount and the right brand of vermouth. "Cinzano," Eddie nearly said aloud. He was trying to imagine what it might be like to work there. It would take him about a year and a half to realize that Penny Pierce had been offering him more than a job. His newfound authority was so new to him. Eddie O'Hare hadn't yet comprehended the extent of his power. Something almost biblical. Meanwhile, back in the bookstore, Ted Cole was reaching calligraphic heights at the autographing table. His penmanship was perfect. His slow, seemingly carved signature was a thing of beauty. For someone whose books were so short and he wrote so little, Ted's autograph was a labor of love. A labor of self-love, Marion had once described Ted's signature to Eddie. To those booksellers who often complained that the signatures of authors were messy scrawls, as indecipherable as doctors' prescriptions, Ted Cole was the king of autographers. There was nothing dashed off about his signature, not even on checks.
The cursive script was more like italicized print than handwriting. Ted complained about the pens. He had Mendelssohn hopping around the shop, searching for the perfect pen. It had to be a fountain pen, one with just the right nib. And the ink had to be black, or else the proper shade of red. More like blood than like a fire engine, Ted explained to the bookseller. As for blue, any shade of blue was an abomination to Ted. And so Eddie O'Hare was lucky. While Eddie took Ruth's hand and walked with her to the Chevy, which was parked on South Main Street in view of the bookstore, Ted took his time. He knew that every autograph seeker who approached him at the signing table was a potential ride home, but he was picky. He didn't want to be just anyone's passenger. For example, Mendelssohn introduced him to a woman who lived in Waynescott. Mrs. Hickenlooper said she would be happy to drop Ted at his house in Sagaponack. It really wasn't out of her way. However, she did have some other shopping to do in Southampton. It would take her a little more than an hour, after which she didn't mind stopping back at the bookstore. But Ted told her not to trouble herself. He said he was sure another ride would come his way within the hour. "But I really don't mind," Mrs. Hickenlooper said. "I mind," Ted thought to himself. Amiably, he waved the woman away. She went off with an inscribed copy of The Mouse Crawling Between the Walls, which Ted had painstakingly dedicated to Mrs. Hickenlooper's 5 children. She should have bought 5 copies, Ted believed, but he dutifully signed the one, fitting all 5 names of the Hickenlooper progeny on a single, crowded page. "My kids are all grown up now," Mrs. Hickenlooper told Ted, "but they sure loved you when they were little ones." Ted just smiled. Mrs. Hickenlooper was pushing 50. She had hips like a mule. There was a farm-like solidity to her. She was a gardener, or so it appeared. She wore a broad denim skirt, and her knees were red and stained with soil. "There's no way to be a good weeder without kneeling," Ted had overheard her telling another man in the bookstore. He was a fellow gardener, apparently. They were comparing gardening books. It was ungenerous of Ted to take a disparaging view of gardeners. After all, he owed his life to Mrs. Vaughan's gardener, for if the courageous man hadn't warned Ted to run, Ted might not have escaped the Black Lincoln. Nevertheless, Mrs. Hickenlooper just wasn't the ride home that Ted Cole was looking for. Then he spotted a more promising candidate. A standoffish young woman, she was at least of legal driving age, had hesitated in her approach to the autographing table. She was observing the famous author and illustrator with a characteristic combination of shyness and frolicsomeness that Ted associated with girls who stood on the threshold of attaining more womanly qualities. In a few years, what was now hesitant about her would turn calculating, even shrewd. And what was now coltish, even daring, soon would be better contained. She had to be at least 17, but not yet 20. She was both frisky and awkward, both unsure of herself and eager to test herself. She was a little clumsy, but she was bold. Probably not a virgin, Ted was thinking. Yet she was very inexperienced, he was sure. "Hi," he said. The pretty girl, who was almost a woman, was so startled by Ted's unexpected attention that she was speechless. She also turned a prominent shade of red, midway between blood and a fire engine. Her friend, a vastly plainer, deceptively stupid-looking girl, exploded into snorts and giggles. Ted had failed to notice that the pretty girl was in the company of an ugly friend. With any interesting-looking young woman of a fragile age, wasn't there always an oafish, unappealing companion to contend with? But Ted was undaunted by the sidekick. If anything, he saw her as an intriguing challenge. If her presence meant it was unlikely that he would get laid today, the potential seduction of the pretty young woman was no less inviting to him. As Marion had pointed out to Eddie, it was less the occurrence of sex than the anticipation of it that titillated Ted. He seemed driven less to do it than he was driven to look forward to it.
Hi, the pretty girl finally managed to reply. Her pear-shaped friend couldn't contain herself. To the embarrassment of the pretty girl, the ugly one said, "She wrote her freshman English term paper on you."
"Shut up, Effie," the pretty girl said.
"So she's a college girl," Ted Cole concluded. He guessed that she worshipped the door in the floor. "What was the title of your term paper?" Ted asked. "An analysis of the atavistic symbols of fear in the door in the floor," the pretty girl, who was clearly mortified, said. "You know, like the boy not being sure that he wants to be born, and the mother not being sure that she wants to have him, that's very tribal. Primitive tribes have those fears. And the myths and fairy tales of primitive tribes are full of images like magic doors and children disappearing, and people being so frightened that their hair turns white overnight. And in myths and fairy tales, there are lots of animals that can suddenly change their size, like the snake. The snake is very tribal, too, of course."
"Of course," Ted agreed. "How long was this paper?"
12 pages, the pretty girl informed him, not counting the footnotes and the bibliography.
"Not counting the illustrations. Just manuscript pages in ordinary double-spaced typescript. The door in the floor was only a page and a half long. Yet it had been published as if it were a whole book, and college students were permitted to write term papers about it."
What a joke, Ted was thinking. He liked the girl's lips. Her mouth was round and small, and her breasts were full. They were almost fat. In a few years, she would have to struggle with her weight, but now her plumpness was appealing, and she still had a waist. Ted was fond of assessing women by their body types. With most women, Ted believed he could visualize what the future would do to their bodies. This one would have one baby and lose her waist. She would also run the risk of her hips taking over her body, whereas now her voluptuousness was contained, if barely. By the time she's 30, she'll be as pear-shaped as her friend, Ted was thinking. But all he said was, "What's your name?"
"Glory. Not with a Y, but with an I-E," the pretty girl replied. "And this is Effie."
"I'll show you something atavistic, Glory," Ted was thinking. Weren't 45-year-old men and 18-year-old girls frequently paired together in primitive tribes? "I'll show you something tribal," Ted Cole thought. But what he said was, "I don't suppose you girls have a car. Believe it or not, I need a ride."
Believe it or not, Mrs. Vaughn, having lost Ted, had irrationally directed her considerable anger toward her brave but defenseless gardener. She'd parked the Lincoln, facing out, motor running, in the entrance of her driveway. The black nose of the car's sleek hood and its gleaming silver grill were poking into Gin Lane. Poised at the steering wheel, where she sat for almost a half hour until the Lincoln ran out of gas, Mrs. Vaughn waited for the 57 black-and-white Chevy to make the turn onto Gin Lane from either Wyandanch Lane or South Main Street. She thought that Ted would not stray far from the vicinity, for she, along with Ted, still presumed that Marion's lover, the pretty boy, as Mrs. Vaughn thought of Eddie, remained Ted's chauffeur. Therefore, Mrs. Vaughn turned up the tune on the radio and waited. Inside the black Lincoln, the music throbbed. The sheer volume and the degree to which the bass vibrated the speakers in the car almost concealed from Mrs. Vaughn that the Lincoln had run out of gas. Had the car not shuddered so violently at that moment, Mrs. Vaughn might have gone on waiting at the steering wheel until her son was brought home from his afternoon tennis lessons. More important, that the Lincoln finally ran out of gas may have spared Mrs. Vaughn's gardener a cruel death. The poor man, whose ladder had been knocked from under him, had all this while been trapped in the remorseless privet, where the carbon monoxide fumes from the Lincoln's exhaust had at first made him sick and then nearly killed him. He was half asleep, but conscious of the fact that he was half dead, when the car conked out and a fresh sea breeze revived him.
In an earlier effort to climb down from the top of the hedge, the heel of his right foot had become stuck in a twisted notch of the privet. In attempting to free his boot from the notch, the gardener had lost his balance and fallen upside down in the thick hedge, thus wedging his boot heel more snugly than before in the tenacious privet. His ankle was sorely twisted in the fall, and, hanging by his heel in the tangled hedge, he had pulled an abdominal muscle while trying to untie his boot. A small man of Hispanic descent, with an appropriately small pot belly, Eduardo Gomez was not used to performing upside-down sit-ups in a hedge. His boots were of the above-ankle sort, and although he'd struggled to sit up long enough to untie the laces, he had not been able to bear the pain of the position long enough to loosen the laces. The boot would not slip off. Meanwhile, Mrs. Vaughn couldn't hear Eduardo's calls for help above the volume and the throbbing bass of her car radio. The miserable hanging gardener, aware of the rising fumes from the Lincoln's exhaust, which were gathering in the dense and seemingly airless hedge, was convinced that the privet would be his final resting place. Eduardo Gomez would be the victim of another man's lust, and of another man's proverbial woman scorned. Nor did the dying gardener miss the irony that it was the shredded pornographic drawings of his employer that had led him to his position in the murderous privet. Had the Lincoln not run out of gas, the gardener might have become Southampton's first fatality ever ascribed to pornography. But doubtless not the last, Eduardo was thinking as he drifted half off in the carbon monoxide fumes. It crossed his poisoned mind that Ted Cole deserved to die this way, but not an innocent gardener. In Mrs. Vaughn's view, her gardener was not innocent. Earlier, she'd heard him cry out, "Run!" By warning Ted, Eduardo had betrayed her. If the wretched dangling man had kept his mouth shut, Ted would not have been afforded those valuable extra seconds. As it turned out, Ted had broken into a full sprint before the black Lincoln had shot onto Gin Lane. Mrs. Vaughn was certain that she would have flattened him as incontrovertibly as she'd flattened the road sign at the corner of South Main Street. It was because of her own disloyal gardener that Ted Cole had got away. Thus, when the Lincoln ran out of gas and Mrs. Vaughn got out of the car, first slamming the door shut and then opening it again, for she'd forgotten to turn off the infernal radio, she first heard Eduardo's weakened cries for help, and her heart was instantly hardened against him. She tromped on the little crushed stones of the courtyard, nearly tripping on the fallen ladder, and there she beheld her betrayer, who was ridiculously suspended by his foot in the midst of the privet. Mrs. Vaughn was further incensed to see that Eduardo had not yet cleaned up those revealing drawings. In addition, there was a totally illogical aspect to her hatred of the gardener. He had doubtless seen her terrible nakedness in the drawings. How could he not have seen it? And so she hated Eduardo Gomez in the manner that she hated Eddie O'Hare, who had also seen her so exposed. "Please, ma'am," Eduardo begged her, "if you are able to lift the ladder, if I can just hold on to it, I might be able to get down." "You!" Mrs. Vaughn shouted at him. She picked up a handful of the little stones and threw them into the hedge. The gardener shut his eyes, but the privet was so thick that none of the stones hit him. "You warned him, you vile little man!" Mrs. Vaughn screamed. She threw another handful of stones, which were equally harmless. That she couldn't manage to hit a motionless, upside-down gardener made her even madder. "You betrayed me!" she cried. "If you'd killed him, you'd have gone to jail!" Eduardo tried to reason with her, but she was strutting away from him. Even upside down, he could tell that she was returning to her house. Her purposeful little steps, her tight little butt, he knew before she got to the door that she was going to slam it behind her. Eduardo had long ago imagined this about her. She was a woman of tantrums, a veteran door-slammer. As if the big bang that the door made offered her consolation for her diminutiveness. The gardener had a dread of small women. He'd always imagined them to have an anger disproportionate to their size. His own wife was large and comfortingly soft. She was a good-natured woman with a generous, forgiving disposition. "Clean up this mess, and then leave. This is your last day," Mrs. Vaughan was shouting to Eduardo, who hung perfectly still, as if paralyzed by disbelief. "You're fired," she added. "But I can't get down," he called softly to her, knowing even before he spoke that the door would slam shut on his words. Despite the pulled muscle in his abdomen, Eduardo found the strength to surmount his pain. Doubtless he was helped by a sense of injustice, for he managed to perform another upside-down sit-up. He held the agonizing position long enough to sufficiently unlace his boot. His trapped foot slipped free. He plummeted, head-first, through the heart of the hedge, flailing with both arms and legs, and, to his relief, landed on all fours among the roots. He crawled into the courtyard, spitting out twigs and leaves. Eduardo was still nauseated and dizzy and intermittently lethargic from his lengthy exposure to the Lincoln's exhaust fumes, and his upper lip had been cut by a branch. He tried to walk, but he quickly returned to all fours, and in this animalistic state he approached the clogged fountain. He plunged his head into the water, forgetting the squid ink. The water was foul and fishy-smelling, and when the gardener withdrew his head from the fountain and wrung the water out of his hair, his face and hands were sepia-colored. Eduardo felt like throwing up while he climbed the ladder to retrieve his boot. Then the stunned man limped aimlessly about the courtyard. Since he'd already been fired, what point was there in his completing the task of gathering the scraps of pornography, as Mrs. Vaughan had demanded? He could see no wisdom in performing any task for a woman who had not only fired him, but had also left him for dead. Yet when he decided that he would leave, he realized that the out-of-gas Lincoln was obstructing the driveway. Eduardo's truck, which was always parked out of sight behind the tool house and the garage and the potting shed, could not slip past the privet while the Lincoln was blocking the way. The gardener had to siphon gas from the lawnmower in order to start the Lincoln and return the abandoned car to the garage. Alas, this activity did not go unnoticed by Mrs. Vaughan. She confronted Eduardo in the courtyard, where only the fountain separated them. The stained pool was now as unsightly as a shallow birdbath in which 100 bats had drowned. Mrs. Vaughan held something in her hand. It was a check. And the wrecked gardener eyed her warily. He limped sideways, keeping the fountain between them, as Mrs. Vaughan began to circle the blackened water in his direction. "Don't you want this? It's your last paycheck," the evil little woman said. Eduardo halted. If she was going to pay him, perhaps he would stay and clean up the last of the ripped-to-shreds pornography. After all, the maintenance of the Vaughan estate had been his principal income for many years. The gardener was a proud man, and the miniature bitch had humiliated him. Yet he thought that even if the check she was offering him was the last paycheck he would ever receive from her, it would be sizable. With his hand held out in front of him, Eduardo cautiously inched around the spoiled fountain in Mrs. Vaughan's direction. She allowed him to approach her. She was almost within his reach when she made several hasty folds in the check, and, when it was crudely shaped like a boat, she launched it into the murky water. The check sailed into the middle of the funereal pool. It was necessary for Eduardo to wade into the fountain, which he did with trepidation. "Go fish!" Mrs. Vaughan shrieked at him. Even as he plucked the check out of the water, Eduardo was aware that the ink had run. He couldn't read what the amount had been, or Mrs. Vaughan's cramped signature. And before he could step out of the fishy-smelling fountain, he knew, without once looking at her haughty, retreating figure, the door would slam again. The fired gardener dried the worthless check against his pants and preserved it in his wallet. He didn't know why he bothered. Dutifully, Eduardo returned the ladder to its usual keeping place alongside the potting shed. He saw a rake that he'd meant to repair and briefly wondered what he should do with it. He left it on the work table in the tool house. He would have gone home then
He was already limping slowly toward his truck, but he suddenly saw the three large leaf bags that he'd already filled with the scraps of the shredded drawings. He had calculated that the remaining mess, when it was all cleaned up, might fill another two bags. Eduardo Gomez picked up the first of the three full bags and emptied it on the lawn. The wind quickly blew some of the paper all around, but the gardener was dissatisfied with the results. He ran limping through the pile of paper, kicking his feet like a child in a heap of leaves. The long tatters flew through the garden and draped the birdbath. The beech roses at the back of the yard, where the footpath led to the beach, were a magnet to the scraps and shreds of paper. The torn paper clung to everything it touched, like tinsel to a Christmas tree. The gardener limped into the courtyard with the remaining two full bags. The first of these he upended in the fountain, where the mass of ripped drawings soaked up the blackened water like a giant immovable sponge. The last full bag, which by coincidence included some of the best, albeit largely destroyed, views of Mrs. Vaughan's crotch, was no challenge to Eduardo's remaining creativity. The inspired man limped in circles around the courtyard, holding the open bag above his head. It was like a kite that refused to fly, but the countless snippets of pornography did indeed take flight. They rose into the privet from which the heroic gardener had earlier plucked them, and they rose above the privet, too. As if to reward Eduardo Gomez for his courage, a strong sea breeze blew partial views of Mrs. Vaughan's breasts and vagina to both ends of Gin Lane. It was later reported to the Southampton police that two boys on bicycles were treated to a questionable glimpse of Mrs. Vaughan's anatomy, which the boys found as far away as First Neck Lane, a testimony to the strength of the wind which had blown this particular close-up of Mrs. Vaughan's nipple and her irregularly enlarged areola across Agawam Lake. The boys, who were brothers, brought the scrap of the pornographic drawing home, where their parents discovered the obscenity and called the cops. Agawam Lake, which was no larger than a pond, separated Gin Lane from First Neck Lane, where, at the very moment Eduardo released the remains of Ted Cole's drawings, the artist himself was pursuing his seduction of a slightly overweight 18-year-old girl. Glory had brought Ted home to meet her mother, largely because the girl had no car of her own and needed her mother's permission in order to borrow the family vehicle. It had not been too long a walk from the bookstore to Glory's house on First Neck Lane, but Ted's subtle courtship of the college girl had several times been interrupted by insulting questions from Glory's pathetic, pear-shaped friend. Effie was far less a fan of the door in the floor than Glory was. The tragically unattractive girl had not written her term paper on the perceived atavism in Ted Cole's Symbols of Fear. Though she was intensely ugly, Effie was a lot less full of shit than Glory was. Effie was a lot less full of shit than Ted, too. In fact, the fat girl was insightful. She wisely grew to dislike the famous author in the course of their short walk. Effie also saw the efforts of Ted's seduction in progress for what it was. Glory, if she saw what was progressing, offered little resistance. That Ted took an unexpected interest of a sexual kind in Glory's mother surprised him. If Glory was a little too young and inexperienced for his usual taste, and she was borderline overweight, Glory's mom was older than Marion and the type of woman Ted generally ignored. Mrs. Mounseer was preternaturally thin, the result of an eating disorder brought on by her husband's recent and wholly unanticipated death. She was clearly a widow who'd not only deeply loved her husband, she was also, and this was obvious even to Ted, a widow still caught in the detectable stages of grief. What are those stages? Ted was trying to remember. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. Of these, in Marion's case, the last stage, acceptance, was the worst. In Mrs. Mounseer's case, she may have been suffering on that Friday morning from all five. In short, she was not a woman who could be seduced by anybody. Yet Ted Cole was not just anybody, and he couldn't suppress his unpredictable attraction to her. Glory must have inherited her penchant for curvaceousness from a grandmother or an even more distant relation. Mrs. Mounseer was a classical but wraith-like beauty, a pretender in Marion's inimitable mold. Whereas Marion's perpetual sorrow had turned Ted away from her, Mrs. Mounseer's regal sadness turned Ted on. Yet his attraction to her daughter was undiminished. It was suddenly the two of them he wanted. In a similar situation, most men might have thought, what a dilemma. But Ted Cole thought only in terms of possibilities. What a possibility, he was thinking, as he allowed Mrs. Mounseer to make him a sandwich. After all, it was almost lunchtime. And he yielded to Glory's insistence that he allow her to put his wet blue jeans and his soaked-through shoes in the dryer. They'll be dry in 15 or 20 minutes, the 18-year-old promised. The shoes would take at least a half hour. But what was the hurry? While he ate his lunch, Ted wore a bathrobe belonging to the late Mr. Mounseer. Mrs. Mounseer had shown Ted where the bathroom was, so he could change, and she'd handed him her dead husband's bathrobe with an especially appealing sort of sadness. Ted had never tried to seduce a widow before, not to mention a mother and her daughter. He'd spent the summer drawing Mrs. Vaughan. The illustrations for the unfinished A Sound Like Someone Trying Not to Make a Sound had been long neglected. He'd barely begun to think about what those illustrations should be. Yet here, in a comfortable house on First Neck Lane, a mother and daughter portrait of unusual promise had presented itself to him. He knew he had to try it. Mrs. Mounseer did not eat lunch. The thinness of her face, which looked frail and brittle in the midday light, suggested that she had at best an intermittent appetite or that she had some difficulty keeping food down. She delicately powdered the dark circles under her eyes. Like Marion, Mrs. Mounseer could only sleep for short periods of time, when she was utterly exhausted. Ted noticed that the thumb of Mrs. Mounseer's left hand could not leave her wedding ring alone, although she was unaware of how constantly she touched it. When Glory saw what her mother was doing to her wedding ring, she reached out and squeezed her hand. The look that Mrs. Mounseer gave her daughter was both thankful and apologetic. The sympathy passed between them like a letter slipped under a door. In the first of the drawings, Ted would pose them with the daughter holding her mother's hand. "You know, this is quite a coincidence," he began, "but I've been looking for two suitable subjects for a mother and daughter portrait. It's something I've been thinking about for my next book."
"Is it another children's book?" asked Mrs. Mounseer.
"Categorically, yes," Ted answered her. "But I don't think that any of my books are truly for children. First of all, there are the mothers who must buy them, and usually the mothers are the first to read them aloud. Children usually hear them before they're able to read them, and when those children are adults, they often go back to my books and read them again."
"That's just how it happened to me," Glory said.
Effie, who was sulking, rolled her eyes. Everyone but Effie was pleased. Mrs. Mounseer had been assured that mothers came first. Glory had been congratulated for no longer being a child. The famous author had recognized that she was an adult now.
"What sort of drawings do you have in mind?" Mrs. Mounseer asked.
"Well, at first I would want to draw you and your daughter together," Ted told her. "That way, when I draw each of you separately, the presence of the one who's missing is, well, somehow there."
"Wow! Do you want to do it, Mom?" Glory asked.
Effie was rolling her eyes again, but Ted never paid much attention to someone who wasn't attractive.
"I don't know how long it would take," Mrs. Mounseer asked, "or which of us would you want to draw first? I mean, separately? I mean, after you've drawn us together."
In a rush of desire, Ted realized that the widow was a wreck. "When do you go back to college?"
Ted asked Glory.
September 11th or something, Glory said. September 9th, Effie corrected her. And you were going to spend Labor Day weekend in Maine with me, Effie reminded her friend.
I should do Glory first, then, Ted told Mrs. Mounsier. First the two of you together, then Glory alone. Then, when Glory is back in college, you alone.
Oh, I don't know, Mrs. Mounsier said. Come on, Mom. It'll be fun, Glory said.
Well, it was Ted's famous, never-ending, well.
Well what? Effie asked rudely.
I mean, you don't have to decide today, Ted told Mrs. Mounsier. Just think about it, he said to Glory. Ted could tell what Glory was already thinking about. Glory would be the easy one. And then, what a long fall and winter it might be.
Ted was imagining the vastly slower seduction of the grieving Mrs. Mounsier. It might take months, even a year. It called upon tact to permit both the mother and daughter to drive him back to Sagaponack. Mrs. Mounsier volunteered. Then she realized that she'd hurt her daughter's feelings, that Glory truly had her heart set on driving the famous author and illustrator home.
Oh, please, you do it then, Glory, Mrs. Mounsier said. I hadn't realized how much you wanted to do it.
It won't work if they quarrel, Ted was thinking. Speaking selfishly, he said, he smiled charmingly at Effie. I'd be honored if you all drove me home. Although his charm didn't work with Effie, mother and daughter were instantly reconciled, for now.
Ted also played the role of peacemaker when it came to deciding whether Mrs. Mounsier or Glory should drive.
Personally, he said, smiling at Glory, I think people of your age are better drivers than their parents. On the other hand, he turned his smile to Mrs. Mounsier, people like us are unbearable backseat drivers. Ted turned back to Glory. Let your mother drive, he told the girl. It's the only way to keep her from being a backseat driver.
Although Ted had seemed indifferent to Effie rolling her eyes, this time he anticipated her. He turned to the ugly wretch and rolled his eyes, just to show her that he knew. To anyone seeing them, they were seated in the car like a reasonably normal family. Mrs. Mounsier was at the wheel with the convicted DWI celebrity in the passenger seat beside her. In the back were the children. The one with the misfortune to be ugly was, naturally, sullen and withdrawn. It was probably to be expected because her apparent sister was comparatively pretty. Effie sat behind Ted, glaring at the back of his head. Glory leaned forward, filling the space between the two front seats of Mrs. Mounsier's dark green Saab. By turning in his seat to view Mrs. Mounsier's stunning profile, Ted could also glimpse her vivacious, if not exactly beautiful, daughter. Mrs. Mounsier was a good driver who never took her eyes off the road. The daughter couldn't take her eyes off Ted. For a day that had started out so badly, look what opportunities had come out of it. Ted glanced at his watch and was surprised to see that it was early in the afternoon. He would be home before 2, plenty of time to show the mother and daughter his workroom while there was still good light. You can't judge a day by its beginning, Ted had decided, as Mrs. Mounsier passed Agawam Lake and turned from Dune Road onto Gin Lane. Ted had been so transfixed by the visual comparison between mother and daughter that he'd not been watching the road.
Oh, you're going this way, he said in a whisper.
Why are you whispering? Effie asked him.
On Gin Lane, Mrs. Mounsier was forced to slow the car to a crawl. The street was littered with paper. It hung from the hedges. As Mrs. Mounsier's car passed, the paper swirled around it, a piece stuck to the windshield. Mrs. Mounsier considered stopping the car.
Don't stop, Ted told her. Just use your windshield wipers.
Talk about backseat drivers, Effie remarked. But to Ted's relief, the windshield wipers worked. The offending scrap of paper flew on.
Ted had briefly seen what he was sure was Mrs. Vaughn's armpit. It was from one of the most compromising series, when she was on her back with her hands crossed behind her head. "What is all this stuff?" Glory asked.
"Someone's trash, I guess," her mother replied.
"Yes," Ted said. "Someone's dog must have gone into someone's trash."
"What a mess," Effie observed.
"They should fine whoever it is," Mrs. Mounsey said.
"Yes," Ted agreed. "Even if the culprit is a dog, fine the dog." Everyone but Effie laughed. As they neared the end of Gin Lane, a spirited gathering of shredded paper flew all around the moving car. It was as if the ripped drawings of Mrs. Vaughn's humiliation didn't want to let Ted go. But the corner was turned. The road ahead was clear. Ted felt a surge of wild happiness, but he made no attempt to express it. A rare moment of reflection overcame him. It was something almost biblical. In his undeserved escape from Mrs. Vaughn, and in the stimulating company of Mrs. Mounsey and her daughter, Ted Cole's overriding thought repeated itself in his mind like a litany. Lust begets lust, begets lust, begets lust, over and over again.
That was the thrill of it.
The authority of the written word. The story that Eddie told Ruth in the car was something she would always remember. When she even momentarily forgot it, she only had to look at the thin scar on her right index finger, which would always be there. When Ruth was in her 40s, the scar was so small that it was visible only to her or to someone who already knew it was there, someone who was looking for it.
"There was once a little girl," Eddie began. "What was her name?" Ruth asked.
"Ruth," Eddie replied.
"Yes," Ruth agreed. "Go on."
"She cut her finger on some broken glass," Eddie continued, "and her finger bled and bled and bled. There was much more blood than Ruth thought could possibly be in her finger. She thought the blood must be coming from everywhere, from her whole body."
"Right," Ruth said.
"But when she went to the hospital, she needed only 2 shots and 2 stitches, Eddie reminded the child.
3 needles, Ruth reminded him, counting the stitches.
"Oh, yes," Eddie agreed. "But Ruth was very brave, and she didn't mind that for almost a week she couldn't swim in the ocean or even get her finger wet when she took a bath."
"Why didn't I mind?" Ruth asked him.
"Okay, maybe you minded a little," Eddie admitted, "but you didn't complain about it."
"I was brave?" the 4-year-old asked.
"You were. You are brave," Eddie told her.
"What does brave mean?" Ruth asked him.
"It means that you don't cry," Eddie said.
"I cried a little," Ruth pointed out. "A little is okay," Eddie told her. "Brave means that you accept what happens to you. You just try to make the best of it."
"Tell me more about the cut," the child said. "When the doctor took out the stitches, the scar was thin and white and a perfect straight line," Eddie told her. "In the whole rest of your life, if you ever need to feel brave, just look at your scar." Ruth stared at it.
"Will it always be there?" she asked Eddie.
"Always," he told her. "Your hand will grow bigger, and your finger will grow bigger, but the scar will stay the same size. When you're all grown up, the scar will look smaller, but that will be because the rest of you has grown bigger. The scar will always be the same. It will just not be as noticeable, which means that it will become harder and harder to see. You'll have to show it to people in good light, and you'll have to say, 'Can you see my scar?' And they'll have to look really closely. Only then will they be able to see it. You'll always be able to see it because you'll know where to look. And, of course, it will always show up on a fingerprint."
"What's a fingerprint?" Ruth asked.
It's kind of hard to show you while we're in the car, Eddie admitted. When they got to the beach, Ruth asked him again, but even in the wet sand, Ruth's fingers were too small to leave clear fingerprints, or else the sand was too coarse. As Ruth played in the shallow water, the yellow-brown antiseptic was completely washed away, but the scar remained a bright white line on her finger. Not until they went to a restaurant could she see what a fingerprint was. There, on the same plate with her grilled cheese sandwich and her French fries, Eddie poured out a spreading puddle of ketchup. He dipped the index finger of Ruth's right hand in the ketchup and gently pressed her finger on a paper napkin. Beside the fingerprint of her right index finger, Eddie made a second print, this time using the index finger from Ruth's left hand. Eddie told her to look at the napkin through her water glass, which magnified the fingerprints so that Ruth could see the unmatched whorls. And there it was, as it would be forever, the perfectly vertical line on her right index finger. Seen through the water glass, it was nearly twice the size of the scar itself. Those are your fingerprints. Nobody else will ever have fingerprints like yours, Eddie told her. And my scar will always be there? Ruth asked him again. Your scar will be a part of you forever, Eddie promised her. After their lunch in Bridgehampton, Ruth wanted to keep the napkin with her fingerprints. Eddie put it in the envelope with her stitches and her scab. He saw that the scab had shriveled up. It was a quarter the size of a ladybug, but of a similar russet color and spotted black. At about 2:15 on that Friday afternoon, Eddie O'Hare turned onto Parsonage Lane, Sacaponic. When he was still some distance from the Coles' house, he was relieved to see that the moving truck and Marion's Mercedes were nowhere in sight. However, an unfamiliar car, a dark green Saab, was parked in the driveway. As Eddie slowed the Chevy to a crawl, Ted, the obdurate womanizer, was saying goodbye to the three women in the Saab. Ted had already shown his workroom to his future models, Mrs. Mounseer and her daughter Glory. Effie had refused to leave the back seat of the car. Poor Effie was ahead of her time. She was a young woman of integrity and insight and intelligence, trapped in a body that most men either ignored or spurned. Of the three women in the dark green Saab on that Friday afternoon, Effie was the only one with the wisdom to see that Ted Cole was as deceitful as a damaged condom. For a heart-stopping second, Eddie thought that the driver of the dark green Saab was Marion. But as Eddie turned into the driveway, he saw that Mrs. Mounseer did not as closely resemble Marion as he'd thought. For just a second, Eddie had hoped that Marion had had a change of heart. She's not leaving Ruth, he thought, or me. But Mrs. Mounseer was not Marion. Nor did Mrs. Mounseer's daughter, Glory, resemble Alice, the pretty college girl nanny whom Eddie despised. Eddie had also jumped to the conclusion that Glory was Alice. Now Eddie realized that they were merely a bunch of women who'd given Ted a ride home. The boy wondered which one Ted had taken an interest in. Certainly not the one in the back seat, Eddie thought. As the dark green Saab pulled out of the driveway, Eddie could instantly tell from Ted's innocent, only mildly puzzled expression that he didn't know Marion was gone. "Daddy! Daddy!" Ruth cried. "Do you want to see my stitches? There are four pieces, and I got a scab. Show Daddy the scab," the four-year-old told Eddie, who handed Ted the envelope. "Those are my fingerprints," the child explained to her father. He was staring at the paper napkin with the ketchup stains. "Careful the scab doesn't blow away in the wind," Eddie warned Ted. The scab was so small that Ted peered at it without taking it out of the envelope. "That's really neat, Ruthie," Ruth's father said. "So, you were at the doctor getting her stitches taken out?" Ted asked Eddie. "And we went to the beach and we had lunch," Ruth told her father.
I had a grilled cheese sandwich and French fries with ketchup, and Eddie showed me my fingerprints. I'm going to keep my scar forever.
That's nice, Ruthie. Ted was watching Eddie take the beach bag out of the Chevy.
On top were the pages of stationery from the frame shop in Southampton, the story of the summer of 58, which Eddie had written for Penny Pierce. Seeing the pages gave Eddie an idea. He went to the trunk of the Chevy and took out the rematted, reframed photograph of Marion in Paris. Ted was now watching Eddie's every move with an increasing unease.
"I see the photograph was ready, finally," Ted observed.
"We got the feet back, Daddy. The picture is all fixed," Ruth said.
Ted picked up his daughter and held her, kissing her forehead.
"You've got sand in your hair and salt water to rinse out. You need a bath, Ruthie."
"But not a shampoo," Ruth cried.
"Well, yes, Ruthie, you need a shampoo, too."
"But I hate shampoos. They make me cry," Ruth exclaimed.
"Well..."
Ted stopped as usual. He couldn't take his eyes off Eddie. To Eddie, Ted said,
"I waited quite a while for you this morning. Where were you?"
Eddie handed him the pages he'd written for Penny Pierce.
"The lady in the frame shop asked me to write this," Eddie began. "She wanted me to explain to her, in writing, why I wouldn't leave the shop without the photograph."
Ted didn't take the pages, but he put Ruth down and stared at his own house.
"Where's Alice?" he asked Eddie. "Isn't it Alice who's here in the afternoons? Where's the nanny? Where's Marion?"
"I'll give Ruth a bath," Eddie answered him. Once again, the 16-year-old handed Ted the pages.
"Better read this," Eddie told him.
"Answer me, Eddie."
"Read that first," Eddie said.
He picked up Ruth and started carrying her toward the house with the beach bag slung over his shoulder. He held Ruth with one arm, carrying the photo of Marion and the feet in his free hand.
"You haven't given Ruth a bath before," Ted called after him. "You don't know how to give her a bath."
"I can figure it out. Ruth can tell me," Eddie called back to him.
"Read that," Eddie repeated. "Okay, okay," Ted told him.
He started reading aloud.
"Do you have a picture of Marion Cole in your mind?"
"Hey, what is this?"
"It's the only good writing I've done all summer,"
Eddie answered, carrying Ruth inside the house. Once inside, Eddie wondered how he could get Ruth in a bath in any of the house's several bathtubs without her noticing that the photographs of her dead brothers were gone. The phone was ringing. Eddie hoped it was Alice. Still carrying Ruth, he answered the phone in the kitchen. There had never been more than 3 or 4 photos of Thomas and Timothy in the kitchen. Eddie hoped that Ruth might not notice they were gone. And because of the ringing phone, Eddie had rushed through the front hall with Ruth in his arms. Ruth might not have noticed the darker rectangles of unfaded wallpaper. The bare walls were also distinguished by the picture hooks which Marion had left behind. It was Alice on the phone. Eddie told her to come over right away. Then he put Ruth over his shoulder and, holding her tight, he ran with her up the stairs.
"It's a race to the bathtub," Eddie said. "Which bathtub do you want? Your mommy and daddy's bathtub? My bathtub? Another bathtub?"
"Your bathtub," Ruth shrieked.
He veered into the guest wing hall where he was surprised to see how vividly the picture hooks stood out against the walls. Some of the hooks were black. Some were the color of gold or silver. All of them were somehow ugly. It was as if the house had suffered an infestation of metallic beetles.
"Did you saw that?" Ruth asked.
But Eddie, still running, carried her into his bedroom at the end of the guest wing and then into his bathroom, where he hung the photograph of Marion in the Hotel du Quai Voltaire exactly where it had been when the summer began.